Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I'm Mona, and I was married for 30 years. I was in that relationship for 32, and we didn't find out that we were a neurodiverse couple until our 29th year of marriage. And I've been divorced almost 5 years, and together we have an amazing adult daughter who's thriving and doing fantastic. And today I have another guest on the podcast who's going to share her story and a little bit about all the wonderful work that she is doing. So I want to welcome Katie Zitterbart, and I think I got that right, to the podcast.
You did, yeah. Yeah, awesome. Thanks for having me. I'm so happy to be here with you.
Well, it's a pleasure being able to talk to you again. And I always like to start the podcast by asking my guests to share a little bit with the listeners about your personal journey, your professional journey, and what kind of brought you to doing the work that you're doing now. So if you don't mind sharing that, it'd be awesome.
I don't mind sharing at all. So I'll try to keep this specific to the context we're in, which is neurodiversity and personally, I carry, I think, 8 neurotypes, so yes. I would be considered highly neurodivergent. I'm a late realized diagnosed autist. I come from a family, obviously, of divergent individuals, both neurologically and socially. I'm queer, and both of my parents were gay, which absolutely influenced my early childhood, of course.
Sure.
And I'm the weird one. But, okay. so it sounds like your husband was as well. We are often the weird ones. I think when we first met, I shared that I discovered the phrase idiot savant in, what was it, like sixth grade or something, middle school. And I wrote a report on autism, and that started just a fascination with the brain and with perception in particular. And now that I understand my synesthesia and my neurodivergence, of course, I was curious about all of that. And that has changed over the years, but I've stayed very interested in neuroscience and perception and how we navigate the world, how we understand and interpret input and response. So it's been a passion and a special interest. And then, of course, it profoundly informs my work. So professionally. Yeah. I'm what you would call a polymath.
Explain.
A polymath is, or what else? I don't remember what other words for it, but that would be an individual who has a broad range of knowledge, and the depth is also there. So it makes me an intellectual. So I'm very useful in many contexts, not very useful in others.
Okay.
I have worked as a startup consultant, assisting tech startups, usually before Series B financing, in compliance and cultivating culture in the company. I'm often the person who writes the first HR manual and kind of helps set all of that up. I was like 33, employee 33 or 34 at Yahoo.
Oh, wow.
And we were, human algorithming the internet at that point, because the World Wide Web had just really happened. Dave and Jerry got kicked out of Stanford servers, I think like 18 months before I met them. So this was very early on in Web 1.0, and my interest in navigating and perception, I became very skillful at the how do you assist individuals in making complex buying decisions online, because we didn't have all of the infrastructure that we have yet.
Fascinating. Katie, fascinating.
Yeah. When I met them, I had two friends from CMU who were already working there. And my friend Parker called me and he was like, you need to come meet these people. They think like you. And I was like, nobody thinks like me. This is my problem in life, you know? And I got there and I was like, oh, they really do think like me. And it was glorious. And it played into my pattern recognition and the way that I'm able to abstract concepts. And just this week, as I was reflecting on our conversation that we were going to have right now, mm-hmm. it occurred to me that that at Yahoo was also training in how I can use my pattern recognition and understanding of ontology and taxonomy and how meaning happens it absolutely influences my work. There's no way it doesn't. Mm-hmm. And I believe that I'm navigating information the way that I built and helped build the ontology of Yahoo 30 years ago. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I know, Katie, I'll tell you, this is fascinating. Yeah. And I know we talked a little about this when we met, mm-hmm. but I can imagine all the autistic partners and autistic individuals who are listening to this episode going, oh my gosh, she's part of my tribe. She understands
me. I am the spice. I carry the spice, the neuro spice. I am an eight pepper person. I just love the idea of neurospicy. It's so much more fun than neurodivergent. Divergent makes me feel like I'm wrong. Spicy makes me feel like I'm different.
Yes.
Because I'm a sex educator as well, it fits in with that. I was not aware of my autism at that time, though. Yeah. So I was really mostly aware of my ability to extrapolate and associate and then also disseminate, because I was one of the first information architects in this space and usability folks in this space. So I did not stay in the space, obviously, because like many autistics, I figured it out and I was done and ready for the next problem. And they right. didn't have one for me. So I went elsewhere.
Gotcha.
Bad move, Katie. but I did get to work with a lot of really exciting folks in the Bay Area in the 90s because of that. And as the Y2K was approaching, I was like, you know, no, this is not, no. And so I chucked it all. Seriously, went to the high desert in Nevada with my then partner and sat for a year and asked the question, what do you do? Because it's like, that is the question people ask. Wow. What do you do?
And I'm like, what do you
really
do?
My job for work? People want to know what is your role in capitalism, basically, with the what do you do? Okay. And I was just like, that doesn't match my philosophy. I felt very disconnected from my work in software. It's not tangible. It's never finished and it's never correct. That was very bothersome to my sense of justice and my need for things to be correct. The separation from the work speaks to my grad school studies. I have a master's degree in critical theory, which really ended up being Marxist economic theory, and ironically at Carnegie Mellon, and which is hugely ironic.
Which is what? Which
it's
is what?
It's just so ironic because Carnegie Mellon, people would be like, oh, we're proletariats. We're the working class. And I'd be like, no, we're not. We're Carnegie Mellon. What? Like, even if you were working class in your family of origin, you're here now. We are no longer that.
Right.
And then so with the software, I would consider myself a recovering software architect.
Okay.
And business process. I've done a lot of business process engineering. I'm just really interested in how it's human-computer interaction, but I, you know, gave it all up to be an artist and body person. But it's just very fascinating, and it assists me in like creating and understanding my work in a way that I can make it a little bit more tangible and certain for folks, because it is a lot of the embodiment and particularly the more deeply subtle sensation awareness work is exactly that. So it's a lot easier for me to say something like, oh, the homunculus was mapped and paper came out 2 weeks ago. And this is the implication for neurodivergence, as I understand it, and blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, the eyes glaze over and I'll say, okay, smile. And then they go, oh, okay. But there's a lot behind it, right?
Right, right,
and,
right, right.
You know, right. The autistic brain, as you know, we are bottom-up processors. So give me all the details now, Mona. I want them now. Mm-hmm. And then I will tell you my conclusion. And this is not the way the world works. And it's been a real eye-opening thing for me, for sure, over the years.
So interesting.
Yeah. And you wanted to, I'm sorry. You had
no, I was going to say, so as I'm listening to you, mm-hmm. Katie, it's yeah. like, you know, this foundation mm-hmm. that was created in your life through various jobs kind of helped you discover one side of you and allowed you to work with people that maybe understood you in a way others hadn't before. Because, you know, you said you couldn't believe that there were actually people that got
yeah,
you.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that I was understood. That means that oh, I okay. understood.
That what?
That means that I understood, right? It doesn't mean that I was understood.
Gotcha. Okay.
So, because I don't know how other people understand me, which is, I'm sure, I am certain, informs my fascination with perception and cognition. Mm. But yeah, no, I have definitely been able to plug into contexts, you know, companies, projects, collaborations that play to my strengths. And as I have become more aware of what parts of my response system, whatever that is, right, in my body mind, how much of that is trauma from being this neurodivergent and how much of it is actual neurodivergent traits. Mm-hmm. You know, resolving the trauma has also then the traits remain. And that's been a really wonderful way for me to be honoring the neurodivergence and not making it wrong and getting my body mind to a place where I have the capacity to be with my neurodivergent responses to the world.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me flow with this for a little bit.
Please.
Because
yeah.
You have said so much that I've never talked. No. I'm saying this in a good way that I've okay. never talked about on the podcast.
Oh, okay.
And I just know, you know, I know my listeners or a lot mm-hmm. of them because they, you know, connect and they talk right. to me and I know there's going to be so many questions. So okay. before we get into a more in-depth conversation about some of the topics
yeah.
we said we were going to talk about, I want to talk mm-hmm. about a few things you mentioned.
Yes, please.
Okay.
I'm happy to. Yeah.
Awesome. So one of the things that I don't think I've ever talked about on the podcast is synesthesia.
Oh, synesthesia. And, yeah.
Yeah. So you mentioned that, and I'd mm-hmm. love if you could share what sure. that looks like for you.
So synesthesia, I experience it in many ways. The shortcut definition, I think that a lot of us are familiar with, would be like a person who tastes something if you say someone else's name, or folks who see music when they hear sounds. And it is, there are a lot of theories. I'm currently very in favor of the neural pruning. Because I believe that also affects the autistic brain, because the autistic brain has more connections. So like, did we not get pruned at an early age? I don't know.
Yeah.
There must be 80 different distinct forms of synesthesia. And they can be simple and complex. So like complex synesthesia would be you hear a piece of music and like a movie shows up in front of you. I keep using visual references because I have tactile synesthesia in that my body responds to sound in a way that is divergent. And I'm still trying to figure out like which tactile synesthesias, plural, my brain manifests, but it absolutely does. And then on the totally opposite side of that, some folks would say, and I like this just as a concept, is aphantasia. And that is being blind inside. If you hear meows,
that's
it
okay.
Is cats, I gave them shrimp and toys, but they just want to be with us.
It happens every time somebody has a cat and we are doing a Zoom call or a podcast. And there's something about cats wanting to participate. Yeah.
Well, and Darla just is very excited. So aphantasia, I don't see anything in my mind's eye. Nothing. I am 100% blind. So if you asked me to imagine, I think Apple is the common example that I see folks using. I see nothing, absolutely nothing. I used to want to be a geneticist. This was seventh grade, I think, so that I could prove that there were two recessive genes for spelling and that I have them. And so it was genetic, but it was really probably aphantasia because I can't imagine. I don't see in my mind's eye.
Wow.
And now put me in a yoga, mindfulness, or meditation context, which I've been in also I've been working with, thank you, Darla. Yes, since I was 20, so like 35 years almost. Wow. And not once have I ever seen anything that anyone has ever asked me to see in my mind's eye, but I feel a lot. And synesthesia is, I love it. Actually, it's really fun.
And
it's that whole like perception, cognition,
right.
the like literally different, not only different lived experiences, but different modes of operation in the body mind neurologically fascinates me. I just think it's so amazing.
And it is absolutely fascinating, but I will tell you, Katie, the more I learn, the more I realize that in neurodiverse relationships, the conflicts occur over and over again because of misunderstanding. And what you just said is going to be a humongous aha for so many people, because I literally had a conversation yesterday with a neurotypical partner who said to me, does my partner truly not see what I see?
And the answer may be yes.
And I said to her, he does not. And my example, Katie, was I don't know him in great, depth, my example to her was so that it would be concrete and she could understand that this was the truth, or most likely the truth, is I said, if you are sitting with a blind friend at the beach and the sunset is bright orange and red, and you say to your friend, isn't the sunset beautiful? Can't you see the beautiful colors? And they say no.
Yeah.
And you don't believe them.
Yeah.
They're blind. They literally can't open their eyes any wider to be able to see. They literally can't see. And I've used that example. I don't know if I've used it on the podcast, but I've used it in my support groups. Mm-hmm. And when I told her that, Katie, it was like the light bulb went off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And on the other side of that is, does the neurotypical partner possess the interest and vulnerability to learn their partner's perception?
Yes.
And I only say, I'm not saying that because of anything I've heard on your podcast, but I am saying that because culturally, neurodivergence is pathologized, criminalized, sometimes executed. And we are, the evidence-based bullshit that they put kids through with, and I put evidence-based in major, major air quotes, the whole concept of ABA, you know, where you're literally forcing a totally different kind of operating system and hardware system to be another entity. And right. it is very challenging. I did not have to go through it because as a girl child born in the 60s and with my IQ, I just didn't have to, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk again, the more we all learn, the better we can understand our differences mm-hmm. so that they aren't repeated challenges and conflicts in our relationships with others, whether it's friendship or family or a romantic intimate relationship. Mm-hmm. So another thing that I wanted to address mm-hmm. I want to talk about double empathy. But yes. before we do that, you mentioned trauma versus yeah. traits.
And
I've never talked about it in those terms. And I really think that this will be very, again, enlightening yeah. to a lot of folks that are listening. So can you talk a little bit about how you figured out or discovered trauma versus traits?
Well, I'm very happy to do that because it wasn't personal. This is part of my work. So first of all, trauma, the traumatized brain, PTSD or CPTSD, actually, like at this point, we have a globe full of people who have been experiencing active trauma for years, right?
Yeah.
Trauma changes the brain, period. Yeah. It's an acquired neurodivergence. As I understand the research, the writing, the, you know, accounts, the lived experience of me, my brother, my twin, like all these folks, neurodivergent children are off, or, you know, who are lucky enough not to be horribly abused, will be traumatized just by being neurodivergent. And there is so much overlap in things like emotional regulation or sensory motor things or pain that trauma can exacerbate. There's a very strong correlation in comorbidity with autism spectrum disorder and hypermobility problems.
Explain what you mean by hypermobility. Yeah,
I absolutely will. Because this is my nerd.
this is your jam.
Yeah, right. We're at home. So you're going to tell me if I don't make sense.
Okay. You got it.
Fascia, connective tissue, is tissue that innervates everything in the body. And if you've ever cut a piece of piece and there's that like silver skin, a piece of meat and there's silver skin on it, you've got to like yeah. take it off. That's fascia.
Yeah.
And it's connective tissue. The connective tissue disorder that is most strongly correlated to neurodivergence, as I understand it, has to do with having lax or just lax connective tissue. It doesn't hold the structure, which I can't show you because we are on the radio, but the right. fascia has, it operates through biotensegrity. So there's this whole like suspension bridge factor in the, if we had pictures, I would show you, but we don't have pictures. So we have this issue with lax connective tissue. And I think if we go back like 10, 15 years, maybe a little bit longer, research into the potential relationship between connective tissue and the emotional body. Mm-hmm. There's absolutely relationship between connective tissue and pain pathways that also have sex-based differences. The trait, right, is hypermobility or autism or whatever. Let me use myself.
Okay.
The trait is emotional dysregulation, right? So having a difficult time prior in my life, like really keep tuning into like, what is my emotional state right now? But sure. Trauma also messes that up, right?
Yeah.
So resolve the trauma. As you resolve the trauma, and it's complex, it's a lifetime, right?
Right.
So it's a very long process. It requires, you know, licensed, highly specialized. I am not your trauma person. I'm the somatics person. But as you resolve that, if the traits remain, then that's what it is. And I was able to prove this individually for myself in 2020. I didn't mean to.
Thank you, COVID. Was it a COVID-related thing?
Well, I found stage 3 breast cancer in March of 2020.
Wow.
And I live by myself. So I was confronted with having to do pretty much all of my treatment unattended. And there I was like, okay, it's a death process. I'm going into the underworld. I set it up much more like a spiritual initiation than a war, because I was just going to fight to get to chemo every week. I'm not going to fight cancer. Somebody else can do that.
Right.
And I was working with a trauma specialist, obviously, because no way was I going to let COVID or ideation take me out of this challenge that I had accepted, you know, let's cut off a body part and eviscerate and all that crap.
Wow.
And I said to my therapist, I was like, we need to approach this work that we're doing here as though I'm autistic. We're doing this as though I'm autistic. And she was like, you're not autistic. And I said, we're doing it like I'm autistic.
So she did not believe you were autistic.
Well, I am very, very, very high masking.
Okay.
And also when she and I started our relationship, I was resolving partial paralysis from the waist down due to relational trauma. So, but not sexual traumas. But that's just how it manifested. So when she and I met, I was in major, like significant crisis. Mm-hmm. And I would not blame her at all for not knowing how I understand my mind. If the point is like, I would really like to be able to walk.
Right. Right.
And oh my gosh, Mona, I got off the cane, literally put my mobility aid down next day, find cancer. So I think she was appropriately really paying attention to, let's just get to the next step.
Right.
But what happened through that is my autistic traits remained. Mm-hmm. And during that process, of course, I'm bringing in psychiatry because I'm not going to try to stay balanced. Give me all everything. I said yes to everything. You want to give me opiates? Great. They didn't, but I would have. You want to put me on a Zoloft? I'm taking it. Cannabis? Yeah. Sure. So, because why not? It's only 2 years. My body's going to be trashed anyway.
Right.
And so my psychiatrist helped me identify ADHD through the lack of executive function. And I was like, well, is it really that or is it trauma? And then we looked at my life and I was like, okay, yeah, it's probably that too. So here I am going through how much of my life? I'm 53.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
right.
So, but you know, my brother's neurodivergent, his kid is neurodivergent, my parents are neurodivergent, but I was a girl child who got straight A's. There's no way she is. Okay.
So let me stop you for a second, because I want to ask this, because I'm sure folks are going to be interested in, like, what specific traits did you realize, maybe a few of them, were due to autistic. I'm an autistic person versus I'm a person who has experienced, you know, a variety of types of trauma throughout my childhood and adult life. Can you give an example? Yes. Okay, great.
Sense of justice.
Okay.
There's a, which I would, have you discussed that on your podcast?
No.
The autistic, this is one of the ways that autists Can I use autist and holistic here?
Absolutely. You can use whatever words
or divergent,
are most, whatever is most comfortable for you. We use it
divergent
all.
Divergent. Yeah. I'm not, well, because like, to my mind, neurodiversity is so much more than just autism. And I know that most of your audience is in that context. So I just want to make sure that, you know, it's relevant.
Yeah.
So we autists get characterized as being very stubborn and fixed and set and black and white thinking, and we don't understand, you know, metaphor and all this stuff. And so I have, you know, become like profoundly dysregulated, especially in business contexts where people are not behaving ethically. Mm-hmm. And when my body mind was still or is in active trauma, I'm unable to make a distinction between, oh, this is me because like this is how I'm wired. I have this feeling, it's a really strong feeling. And is this the right action for me to take based on it? Because of nervous system dysregulation, I hate that word, but because of nervous system dysregulation. Yeah, so balancing the nervous system, I use the word capacity. It increases one's capacity for discomfort, for surprise, for no, this is wrong, for righteous anger, rather than, this is true for all of us, of course, mm-hmm. rather than I'm just going to plow through. So this autistic sense of justice shows up like, I'm not going to be unethical just because it's convenient.
Right.
I'm not.
Right.
That is rigid. That is certain. That is, you know, everybody thinks they're the good guy. So it's not even necessarily morally superior, but unless and until I am presented with the reason why, and it's not just me that has to benefit, everything has to benefit. I'm staying where I'm staying. And I this also speaks to this, you were talking about the misunderstanding piece, mm-hmm. and how the autistic brain is bottom up and the holistic brain is top down. So we're coming to everything from very different points of view and also ways of understanding.
Yeah.
And the default is to the holistic experience. So neurodivergent individuals have an added burden of like needing to learn how to play in the sandbox.
Yeah.
Did that answer your question?
It does. It does. And it's a perfect example of why I have heard repeatedly from autistic individuals, mm-hmm. and even other neurospicy. I love that word.
I wish I could claim it.
Well, I know my colleague and friend, Carol Jean Whittington, who's the social mm-hmm. Audie, she uses that too. And I love it. And I know a lot of neurospicy people mm-hmm. Will understand that. But also, I do know that there are a lot of, I'm going to say, autistic folks who have told me that they've been fired from jobs.
Oh, yeah.
They have been disowned. They have lost friendships because of their sense of social justice mm-hmm. and justice, period. And that mm-hmm. it is very difficult for the people in their world to understand that it's not about rigidity. It's about equality and
justice
for all, really.
And so why would I waver? There was a study, and I wanted to find it before we chatted and I couldn't. I'll see if I remember. Don't trust me on that, though.
No problem.
That was looking like the question was like, when do you quote do the right thing? And right. Everybody does the right thing when there is a witness.
Right.
Autistic individuals do the right thing regardless, mm-hmm. is what this found. And here's an example from my life. My mother did not give me 3 days' notice. She died very suddenly. I was not prepared.
Really? She didn't give you 3 days' notice?
Well, when my father died, do you know how much paperwork is involved?
Oh,
and
I do.
My brother is out of state, and we've got him and the kid and the dogs. And I'm like, just give me three days. No, I wake up and she's on the floor. That's how she wanted to go. So,
yeah,
so good for her.
Right, but not for you. I get.
I was like, what?
I get.
So, it was actually quite beautiful. I mean, I got to spend the whole day with her, you know. But as I was cleaning the house, my parents were in the house for more than 50 years. After my dad died, we did a lot to prepare so that there wouldn't be a lot. I thought my mom would have a lot more time. She didn't even make it 9 months.
Wow.
The cleanup of the house, this is a sense of justice, this is to the point.
Yeah.
My brother's out of state, and also it would have been horrendously traumatizing for him to have to interact with the things. I'm in state, and that is exactly what I need for closure. So I took on the house.
Okay.
It sold like day one because it was real estate excitement moment. And they probably already had a buyer and I didn't know or whatever. And I finished the cleanup. And by finished the cleanup, I mean, I cleaned it. I had it professionally cleaned while we were cleaning it. I cleaned it again. And then I had it professionally cleaned before I left. This is 2,500 square foot, 100-year-old house. And they were like, the real estate people were like, you don't have to do that. And I was like, what do you mean? I don't have to do that. And they go, well, it's already sold. And I said, which is why I need to do this. And they were like, no, but it's already done. You don't have to. And I said, this person is moving in to somebody else's dwelling that has been inhabited for more than 50 years.
Right.
And also shouldn't have to do a ton of work if we're already doing the work. I would want to not have to clean up a whole bunch of shit, moving into a new house. And so that there's justice right there, right? Where I'm like, no, it's not correct. And I'm literally being told, and I'm using correct instead of right.
Yeah.
Because I want to stay away from like moral implications of, because I know I'm right all the time. But I no longer think I'm superior.
Okay. And so Katie, what you just said made me laugh because I can't tell you how many times in the neurodiverse couple support groups that I facilitate, the autistic person looks at their partner and says, I'm right. And they don't believe me. And it goes back and forth, you know, and it's a constant conflict for a lot of couples because they both think they're right. And you know what? They both might be right. And that's okay.
And then like, where does it matter? Where and
right.
how?
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, like, am I going to go to town toe to toe with somebody about, you know, cleaning in a different context to that level? No. To honor my parents, my family, my ancestors, everybody, and to be respectful to the person moving in, absolutely yes.
Yeah, and you have to be comfortable with yourself when you leave that house and hand the key over to the real estate agent who's going to give it to the other folks. I totally get that. And sometimes it's really difficult in a relationship of any kind, whether it's family members, friends, or a romantic relationship, or even a boss, you know, or a colleague. So that is so important. And it kind of leads us into the big topic I want to talk about that, again, I haven't really talked about on the podcast. And that's the double empathy piece.
Yeah.
And I think it is so critical for everybody listening to really understand what double empathy is. Because I think when we can achieve it in our relationships and we practice it the majority of the time, oh my gosh, we can just be so much more peaceful and content as individuals and in relationships. So I'd love if you could share maybe how you define it and what it looks like for you and what it might look like for others.
Okay. The concept of double empathy, I think, is pretty new. I want to say it's only been around for about 10 years. So let's start there. And it is also related to an idea called theory of mind, which has, it's a, well, you know, of course, you know, developmental concept that has to do with my ability to infer your experience based on nonverbal cues.
Right.
And there is a belief, and I'm calling it a belief again, because I believe in the social model of disability, not in the medical model. There is a belief. Yeah, I could tell. That's why we're talking. Otherwise, we would not be.
Right.
But there is a belief that autistic brains lack theory of mind because of the inability to read subtext. And so are we unable to read subtext, or do we understand what the truth of the full body-mind communication is out of alignment with what the behavior or words are?
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the ways that we get really creepy for folks too, by the way. That like uncanny valley effect that you can have with people experience it with me a lot because I'm so high masking, and then they'll ask me, how am I doing? And I'm like, what? I don't know how to have small talk. And then I become strange and I'm like, oh yeah, there she is again. So double empathy says, so the evil version of double empathy would say autistic people cannot empathize. Autistic people lack theory of mind, and autistic people do not have empathy. The way that it shows up, though, is not that at all.
Right.
And there is, so for me, and honestly, I can't tell you for sure whether how much of this is complex trauma and how much of this is an autistic trait, because my first trauma in life was the near death of me, my twin brother, and my mother when we were being born. So my birth trauma was very significant. And I honestly, at this point, I'm not sure it's even worth trying to separate.
Sure.
But empathy is feeling with, right? And if our nervous system as autists has more connections, if our connective tissue is more lax and therefore has a different kind of way that information and chemicals travel, if we're told that we're wrong all the time for like our own experience, then how would we be able to trust what we're interpreting around somebody else's experience? And so as I understand double empathy, it's less to do with me not having empathy and more to do with how does my empathy align or not with the way somebody else experiences it? And then from there, where do we find ground to exchange empathy in a way that is supportive for everyone in the relationship?
Yes.
But I absolutely have empathy. Some autistics have almost too much, right? Because of how sensitive our nervous systems are.
Yeah. And I love how you describe that. And I think it's going to be really helpful to folks.
Thank
and this
you.
Is something, yeah, I appreciate that. And I really, when I do the support groups with couples, I really like to hone in on that there's three different kinds of empathy. I think they're coming up with a fourth and a fifth too.
Yeah.
But you know, there's emotional, there's cognitive, and then there's compassionate. And sometimes people will use the term affective empathy also for cognitive. And so I think as we learn more about neurodivergence, we learn more about neurological differences and different types of being neurospicy and all of that. If we choose to, and I do think it's a choice, we can begin to understand each other's different types of empathy rather than judge and criticize and begin, you know, conflict, because I could not understand the level of empathy or the type of empathy my ex-husband had. I could not understand it. I could not. And I'll give you a perfect example. Okay. I'll give you a perfect example. And these are things that happen in other relationships, I'm sure. When his father passed away, He did not shed one tear. Mm-hmm. Not one. Not one. Mm-hmm. And I know he and his father didn't have a super close relationship, but I know he loved, I know he loved his father.
And so you know, you're like, why didn't you cry?
Right. And I just couldn't understand it. Right. And the other thing, his mother had, I want to say, 3 heart attacks before the fourth one killed her. Mm-hmm. And he never went to visit her. We lived in a different state than her. And if my mother had had a heart attack, I don't care how.
You would have done something different.
I would have absolutely been on the first plane or in a car or whatever and gone to her bedside. Mm-hmm. And I judged him. Yeah. And I didn't think that the way he acted mm-hmm. was appropriate. And I didn't think he had much empathy. And now the more I learned, the more I realized it just was different. He probably felt things inside that he didn't even realize had words that he could share. And he felt what he felt and didn't maybe know how to explain it to me. And yeah. I think I made him feel less than because he yeah. did not respond in the way that I would have. So I've apologized yeah. to him a bazillion times about so many things, you know, and I just want to share that again. Yeah. I am very vulnerable on the podcast because I guarantee you there are hundreds of folks out there that are going, oh my gosh, I've done that to my autistic partner too.
And I judge them. Yeah. And I've listened to a bunch of your conversations, you know, of course. And I do appreciate I believe you do a very good job of staying away from the autistic person is the one that's wrong and we just have to make them right, which is very challenging because you're holistic. So you're talking about an experience that you've only witnessed and you're doing a great job.
I think that we're all neurologically different. And that's why for me, neurodiverse mm-hmm. love and the work that I'm doing mm-hmm. is about yeah. understanding and acceptance. So yeah. the double empathy piece, Katie, is so mm-hmm. powerful. And I think will help a lot of folks as they move from judgment and conflict and just anger towards understanding and acceptance. Yeah, go ahead.
I like it because it also gives me or, you know, something to discuss that's outside of me, but is fully relevant to the conversation. So instead of me going, well, no, I'm right.
Yeah.
I'll just wait for you to get over here. And my partner saying, well, no, I'm right. I'll just wait for you to get over here. We can be like, oh, look, we're in a double empathy moment. Let's figure it out. Right. And it becomes more like a problem to solve rather than a problem that's wrong.
I love that.
And so I think it encourages, it encourages curiosity, which also then requires safety and security. So it also encourages people to be cultivating compassion and positive regard for each other. And sometimes it's not going to work, and right. that's okay.
Right.
But it doesn't make the brain wrong. It doesn't make, right? It's
right.
the...
Right. I agree.
Yeah.
So let's talk. I totally agree. And that's what these conversations are about. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the felt sense of yes and yes. consent. Because I know, you know, you are working in the area of somatics, but also around sexuality.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about that? And then we're going to talk mm-hmm. a little bit about nervous system. I like mm-hmm. what you said, capacity.
Yeah. The felt sense of yes, I'm sure I didn't come up with it myself. It's too clever a phrase. I want to say it's a Deb Dana phrase.
It could be. It could be.
Doesn't it sound like something she would write?
Yeah.
But so when I'm talking about consent and helping folks, assisting folks in cultivating consent, I'm doing it from the bottom up. Now I know that's because I'm autistic, but also because if you're not feeling it in your body, it's difficult to relax into whatever you've agreed to. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of my somatic work, I'm currently calling it neurospicy embodiment. that is clever. And I came up with that, and I'm sure
I like it
too. Has to do with like tuning in, understanding and naming sensations in the body so that when the emotional body makes itself known, you have some language. The pathologized word is alexithymia, where you can't recognize emotions. Honestly, I believe that the autistic nervous system experiences things at such a subtle level that if you compare it to like that chart of the self, like where do you feel anger, where do you feel happiness with the bodies, and that it's, you see, it looks like thermo.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
That, well, okay, if I'm neurodivergent and I've been told I'm wrong, no, that's not how you do that. That's not how you you should be crying here. You shouldn't be laughing there, whatever. How am I supposed to know what yes is?
Right.
And so the felt sense of yes is an invitation for exploration in a embodied way with the purpose of intimacy and sex, but taking all of that out of it in the moment and really connecting with people like 6 years old. We're playing. We're playing. We are, you know, that when I'm using bowls and sound, I'm not some ascended master. I'm like, this is a toy. We need to play. And as you know, with especially with complex trauma and early childhood trauma, those are parts that need to be recognized and honored as well. And those wounds, I'm not qualified to help anybody. Like that's way outside of my scope of practice, but I know enough that once a person is working over whatever with a proper licensed professional such as yourself, I'm able to help with the embodiment piece. And the felt sense of yes is going to be different for everybody, especially for neurodivergent individuals. So, you know, maybe an ADHDer's felt sense of yes is needing to be able to turn on a dime in a moment with a partner, or, you know, because of attention span, you might need a lot more dynamic stuff in your environment. An autistic individual who has a lot of sensory processing stuff might find that very weird and need more quiet, more dark, more, you know, whatever.
Right.
And so the I'm also in, how can I say, I think three lineages, the Krishnamacharya lineage and the Ghosh lineage from India for yoga and asana. And then my teacher from China, Mantak Chia, for the tantric and the deeper embodiment work that I do. And that is all based on, you begin by literally tuning into your organs. Smile to your liver. Anger lives in the liver. Anger doesn't live in your liver. But hey, man, if your introspection, right, if your understanding of your own emotional body is whacked in some way, then it can be extremely useful to say the idea of anger and forgiveness in this system that predates acupuncture, so it's a proven system, lives in the liver. You know, it's related to the wood element. There is the pairing, the emotional pairing of anger and forgiveness. There's a sound that you can make on exhale. The system is so dynamic. I love it for pattern people because you can interact with it through animals, through colors, through planets, through taste, through body parts, through senses. There's so many ways to enter into that framework, which makes it infinitely customizable.
Well, I think this is, again, this is going to be really fascinating to a lot of folks because, you know, one of the things that I hear, Katie, over and over again is couples who their relationship, their physical intimacy and their sex changed yeah. as mm-hmm. soon as they moved in together yep. or they got married. And there was and I hear this a lot, an exploration. There was a freedom sexually, and then everything shifted. And I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but knowing that once you feel safe, maybe you're more comfortable with being you, and maybe in the beginning you're masking or doing things.
Well, yeah.
That are on script. I don't know. I don't know.
I don't know either. It seems like that. I feel like that's just a thing that happens, though, that many couples, when they move in together, have that experience. So I'm not really sure it's a neurodivergent experience. I will say, though, that self-aware, anybody who's self-aware, and you don't have to be neurodivergent to be self-aware, of course, and right. a lot of neurodivergent people are not self-aware, but if you have that awareness, then you can be looking at how are we going to be cultivating the polarity between us so that we can stay juicy and excited and engaged. We're now going into Katie's land of kink and sexuality education, but you can do that. You can be creating rituals, which is great for neurodivergent individuals. We love a ritual. We love a script. Many of us need scripts. I think this is why you see a lot of autism in BDSM spaces. You see a lot of neurodivergencies yep. because it's so clear. Yep. It's so clear. So I don't know about the everything once you die that, or no, once you die. Yeah, once you move in together.
I know. And the thing is, I think that exploration as a couple is critical rather mm-hmm. than judgment. Okay, so you were really comfortable with your partner in the beginning of the relationship. Maybe you weren't, and maybe you were just doing what you thought you were supposed to do.
Yeah.
So those conversations are so critical, but I think a lot of couples are afraid to have those conversations because, or they may be afraid to have those conversations because maybe they're afraid of the truth. And being afraid of the truth, whatever mm-hmm. it is, whether it's yeah. an individual truth or a truth in your relationship, doesn't lead you down a path of, you know, healthy, balanced relationship.
It
leads to some other things, which we don't have time to talk mm-hmm. about. But let's talk about, let's end with this, Katie. Mm-hmm. I would love for you to share maybe a little bit about your work around the DAO.
Yeah.
And around how you help individuals and couples. And maybe you want to focus on the NeuroSpicy folks or neurodiverse couples. How you help them get to a place that is comfortable, more relaxed, more capacity within their nervous system. What is it that you do to help people get there?
I do what I've been taught.
Okay.
So the framework that I've created for myself to operate in has four pillars. There's one pillar is the physical of yoga asana. I'm primarily coming from a yin yoga perspective. I like it because it gives us lots of time and it is Taoist. I've got the Taoist tantra, that's the emotion piece. And those practices, the first three practices that you do in this system, which of course does lead to the 8-hour orgasm and does lead to like multiple whatever for men, I don't know, but it can get there, but it really starts with nervous system regulation and balancing the vagus nerve. Mm-hmm. The vagus nerve innervates, it goes all through, you know, our organs and everything. And in this system that I'm in and the way that I share it, that's where we start. So it starts with people, it just immediately now, but is that something that's correct and right for folks? Not all the time. So I have a client who has experienced very profound, horrendous early childhood trauma and has been having memories. And she came to me wanting to remember. And I said, here, please call this therapist. That is way outside. We're not doing that.
Right.
And so what I can do with, I use lot of heavy, big metal singing bowls in my work. And they're great because they provide deep pressure for folks who are working through or like integrating sexual trauma, just sexuality as an idea for them, we can use the bowls on or near erogenous zones, and there's nothing sexual about it. It's music. And so I remember I was sharing this with a sex therapist. She's actually an ASECT supervisor, a sex therapist recently. And she was like, holy shit, this is better than Sensate Focus. And I was like, that's why you're hiring me, lady. Like, and it is just, she used to be my therapist. She's also, okay. It's because I've known her for like 10 years. She's not a trauma specialist though. She's family. And then there is a piece that has to do with this neurodivergence and like not assuming anything about anybody ever. And then also the Taoist approach to leadership is very contrary to how most relationships, most therapeutic relationships operate, in my experience, especially in the whole like wellness to supremacy pipeline, which I'm a proud disruptor of, but absolutely exist on. I just lost my train of thought because I have very strong feelings about.
That's okay. So let me end with this, because I think we have covered so much important information, and folks are like, oh my gosh, you've opened my eyes. Right. You've opened my eyes to so many things I didn't understand. Right. So I would love if you would share for our listeners, if I am having these challenges in my neurodiverse relationship, these are some of the things that Katie does that I could inquire, or I could contact her and inquire about.
Yeah.
Because I think that you've opened up a door, Katie, that we needed to open on the podcast, but we're just beginning this conversation, really. Yeah. And we're at the end of the podcast. So tell me what somebody would contact you for, and maybe an example or two of what you could do for a neurodiverse couple.
Sure. Let me do it like as though a person was at a distance, because that would create the constraint of not being able to use the bowls directly.
Okay.
We would be having conversations very likely individually. I'm not a counselor, right? So actually I kind of am, but I'm not licensed and I do believe in scope of practice. That the conversation is curious, that the conversation is contained, safely contained. So really setting up a foundation of agreement and consent. And back to this consent thing, right? So we've got to like start from a place of safety and security as much as we're able to. So I actually approached this like building BDSM scenes.
Okay.
As though I'm a service top, right? So
I have no idea what that means. And probably most of the people listening don't. Yeah. So you're gonna have to define that. What does that
mean?
Have
you ever gotten your shoes shined?
No.
Do you know what shoe shining is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like real shoe shining? Yes.
Yeah, like you sit on the big chair and somebody's there with all the that could be an example of service topping, right? Okay. Or that I'm not coming to any of these conversations in hierarchy. None of it.
Okay.
And my job is to listen to hear and to assist other people. Like the only best thing I can do for folks is show up. And the skills that we work on are skills that you can do anywhere. I can breathe anywhere. I can smile anywhere. I can know that I have a breast and be like, oh my gosh, I love my breast so much anywhere. I'm not going to touch it everywhere. Right.
Right.
And so you kind of create this, it's almost like an emotional muscle memory, where, this thing comes up, and then I'm angry. I'll do the sound for my liver. Oh my gosh, that's scary. I'll do this. And it's like a language. It becomes a language. The work that I do is fully bottom up. So it's also very friendly for people who are resolving trauma. There's the mindfulness piece is not where I begin. I begin with the body. Okay. We start with the body. We don't need to know narratives. We don't need to talk about, let's just like see what comes up. And then with regards to like partnering, there is this entire tantric system that we can be having conversations about. And the attitude is that orgasm energy, sex energy is inherently positive. And
amen.
not at all, it's wholesome. That's a good word, right? It's inherently wholesome. Psychologists use word arousal so often, but it is like we're working with arousal energy in the work that I do. It could be pain, mm-hmm. It could be an idea, it could be excitement, it could be whatever. And what I'm really wanting is for people to be able to discover for themselves what it means. I know we're just at time. Can I give you one example that might make sense?
Yes, please.
Okay. This is all like, this is very much, you have to be there. This, the concept of elements is very pervasive in this system. And I'm keen to say emotions are elemental. Mm-hmm. So the wood element, I think I've invoked a few times, is associated with grief and anger. But how many different kinds of wood are there on the planet? And tons. At what stage, right?
Right.
Succulents, topiary. I said recently, I was like, my brain is a bramble bush, not topiary. Like, so what anger, forgiveness, how you experience it, how it manifests, what triggers, like all of that is so individual. Mm-hmm. And we can still contain it in the idea of, in this system that predates acupuncture, that is clearly proven, we're going to place this here. And then I'm also able to assist energetically with the subtle body because that maps to the meridian channels in Chinese medicine. So the sound healing that I do, and this does work at a distance, but not for this, not as well. I'm creating harmonics that create microtones that literally vibrate our lymphatic system and connect to connective tissue.
Wow.
And this is where I know that I'm unique and odd and special in how I'm approaching this. And this is why I believe that Yahoo, we can just David and Jerry and all of the, you know, because of this association that I can do and also my lifelong interest in brains.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So Katie, that was helpful. And I know, again, I know that folks are going to have a lot of questions. I know there are some folks that are going to want to explore this. Another guest, Michael John Carley, who's written a book. He's autistic and he's written a book about sex. And he did talk about, you know, the BDSM world and how that for a lot of autistic folks is much more comfortable because there's rules and there's safe words and there's all this. So I think what I am getting out of, I'm getting so many things out of our conversation, what I'm getting out of it sounds like the amazing work you do is that for those individuals or couples that want to explore areas where they may have felt some trauma or blockage or fear or even pain. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying, you know, sexual pain as much as pain, even emotional pain around sex or around physical intimacy or around emotional intimacy, that you may be a person that they can contact and they may be able to explore some of this because I wanted to kind of bring it to a place where people could understand because the things we're talking about are so different than what I've talked about in the past.
I am writing a course right now that it's actually for my ASECT certification too, called Breathe Into Balance, that presents the foundational concepts of sexual health, yin yoga, you know, Taoism, all that. And then these foundational practices the first practices. And my intention with that is to distribute it far and wide so people can learn this. You don't need any special anything other than a breath. That's all you need. And I don't own it. So I think everybody should have it.
Love it. Okay. So we all have breath. That's for sure. And
you need that to be alive.
Yeah. We all have bodies. Yeah. So Kate, where do people contact you? What is the best way for them to reach you if they want to explore more?
Katie Z. So where is link? I don't know. Let me think.
Well, you have.
I'm all over the internet.
Okay. Yeah. Let's start with your website.
Website is Katie Z. K A Y T E E Z E E .com.
Okay.
And Catherine Zitterbart is often the name I use online, so I sound more important and, you know, grown up than I feel. So any search on Catherine Zitterbart, you will get to me. I'm the only one.
All right.
And then I'm hoping they might be able, folks might be able to, I don't know how much triangulation you appreciate, but if somebody's having a difficult time locating me, I would imagine they can just be like, hey man, how do I find her?
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah.
I will.
But yes, definitely let's talk. And also, you know, queerness, kinky, I mean, there's just so much.
Yeah.
And I much rather be fully customized to the person in front of me than have a formula, but it does make it challenging to describe what we're doing.
Sure. So I will put your contact information in the show notes.
Yeah.
And I want to thank you.
Thank you so much.
I really want to thank you for sharing so much of your personal journey and, you know, giving definition to some things that people are probably experiencing and they didn't know it was part of being neurospicy. Yeah. And thank you for the work that you're doing, because I know there are a lot of people that have fear in these areas of their lives, and it doesn't have to be a place of fear. It can be a place of excitement and pleasure and joy. And
it's how. The question is how. How do we do this? How do we connect? How do you like to be touched? How do it? And because if it's how, then it's possible to do. It's like that earlier when I was talking about the problem being, you know, double empathy, being like, ooh, this is cool. Let's figure it out like a puzzle rather than let's make it right because it's wrong. I don't like that. Yeah.
Yep. That's a great place to end. Thank you so much for your time and sharing your knowledge and your journey. And I appreciate you being on the podcast.
I appreciate this conversation. I cannot even tell you. This was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Awesome.
Thank you for your time.
All right.